Genesis chapter 6. I don't know if there's a more appropriate passage for us to talk about tonight than Genesis chapters 6 through 9. We think we see flooding. Can you imagine what Noah must have been thinking? Anybody have trouble making it through four chapters in 1 week? Good. This is a very familiar story, one that even the youngest of our children are familiar with and can tell you a little bit about. If they can talk, they can tell you a little bit about the story of Noah. And so hopefully this week we were able to look at it with a fresh set of eyes and maybe draw out some things that we've overlooked in the past, because maybe we've only ever heard the story told. Maybe we've never actually read the story until this week. And there are some things in here that are very interesting. And I want us to start, just briefly mention a thing or two from chapter 5. Chapter 5 is commonly referred to as the generations of Adam. And what we find in Genesis chapter 5 is the genealogy from Adam down to Noah. And there's something interesting. One thing as we were preparing to jump into this study of the Bible, we wanted to look for things that were repeated. That's some, as we see phrases or words or terms repeated over and over again, we start to get the idea that's something that has to be important, right? If it's repeated, it must be important. And there is a phrase in Genesis chapter 5 that's repeated that's said about every person in chapter 5 except one. Except Enoch. That phrase is, "And he died." Is that important? It's important for us to see. Was it important for the Israelites as they're reading this for the first time? Was it important for them and for us to see every one of those men, with the exception of Enoch, every one of them died? In that list are good men and bad men. In that list, every one of them are sinners, right? Why did they die?
Because they were mortal.
And they were mortal because their access to the tree of life had been cut off, right? Sin is why they died. Sin is why we die. Chapter 6. Let's talk through the story of Noah, and then we'll look at some ways we'll look at what it would have meant then. And for the Israelites, as they're reading this after the fact, remember, this isn't written to Noah. This isn't written to Noah's sons. This was written to the Israelites. It's been preserved for our benefit as well. And so we want to see what it meant for the Israelites and what it means for us. But let's start by just walking through the story. The PowerPoints are really not that helpful to you, I know. My batteries are dead, or not in there. There it went. Maybe. Okay. Guess it went to sleep. See, it's the same thing every week, just a different heading. And so let's think about, and somehow, I fit everything from these four chapters on this one block. I struggled with that on every other week, and I think the reason was I knew it was a lot. And so I didn't write down as much as I normally would, but I brought in some other notes that I made on the text itself, so just in case. But let's think about, as we come into chapter 6 of the book of Genesis, man's multiplying, and God looks down at what's going on, and God's not happy. He doesn't like what he sees. And so what's he say? Well, first, what does he see? Their heart was on evil continually. He sees wickedness and constant evil thoughts. That doesn't sound familiar to any of us, does it? But God sees that, and he's not pleased. And so what is his first reaction?
He regretted it.
He regretted even making man, making the world, making anything. Here we are, it's several years down the road, but not too many chapters into the Bible, and we've gone from everything being perfect, everything being, in God's words, very good, to him wishing he had never made it in the first place. But he relents a little bit, doesn't he? He decides, I'm not going to destroy everything. And why did he decide he wasn't going to destroy everything? Noah found grace. So verse 6 says, God talking says, so I'm going to destroy everything. Verse 8, but Noah found grace. Noah found favor in the eyes of the Lord. What are some characteristics that the text tells us concerning Noah? What kind of man was Noah? Righteous, faithful, blameless. He walked with God. That's right. And you know, we see those things in verse 9. Righteous, blameless, walked with God. Even among all these evil people, even among all these evil people, they recognized Noah as being different, didn't they? And I'm sure now, as we're talking through this, you've probably already, over the course of the week, you've seen the parallels. But if you haven't, maybe as we're talking through it now, you're starting to see these parallels between Noah and the Israelites and us. So Noah finds grace, he finds favor in the eyes of the Lord, and God said to Noah, good job, Noah. Keep up the good work. Be a good example to others. Or God said to Noah, good job, Noah. Go and tell everybody else what a horrible job they're doing. Try to straighten them out. God said, make an ark. That's an action verb, make, right? Make an ark. The ark. And then he goes into a description of how to make that ark. A very detailed description. The dimensions, the material, and the finishing of the ark, the door, the window, and what the purpose of the ark was going to be. And then he says, bring. He first says, make, and then he says, bring. That's in verse somewhere. 19. Verse 19. Bring. Bring these animals with you. He says, come into the ark with your family. Bring these animals with you. And he also says, take. Take. Take with you every sort of food that's eaten and stored up. That's going to be your food and food for the animals. And so we see some action. God telling Noah, there are some things you must do. And so Noah had a choice there, didn't he? Noah could have said, God likes me. I found God's grace. I'm good to go. Or he could have said, I found God's grace, that's good. And I believe that if I build this ark and I take my family onto this ark and I bring these animals onto this ark, and I take this food onto the ark, that God will save me. I believe that. I'm not going to do it. But I believe if I did it, I'd be saved. And maybe that's good enough for old Noah. But what did Noah do? Verse 22. Noah did all that God commanded him. Was grace important in the salvation of Noah? Yes. Essential, right? Was faith important in the salvation of Noah? Yes, essential. Was obedience important in the salvation of Noah? Absolutely essential. Any comments in chapter 6 about what we see? That's right. He did it all in the way. He did everything God said in the way God said do it. And we leave chapter 6, and we don't know, at the end of chapter 6, we don't know how this works out for Noah. We just know that he did it. Any questions? Comments?
Noah wasn't a young
man either. No, he wasn't. Right, he was in his 80s. And Noah was in his 600s. So. Here's a guy 2/3 of the way through his life, right? Just to give it some perspective. Because we can't imagine 600 years old. We can't imagine working on a project for 100 years. We don't live 100 years, usually. Right. Yes, Kathy. The first four verses, I thought you'd never ask. Or maybe I hoped you'd never ask. Okay, I guess you're wondering about these sons of God and daughters of men. Is that the question?
And the giants,
okay. Let me start with the giants. Well, no, let me start with the sons of God and daughters of men. And it doesn't, does it? They came first in the text, so we'll start with them. All right, so this is my favorite answer. I don't know. But here's what I think. I think the sons of God were that godly line of Seth, and the daughters of men were the ungodly line of Cain. That's what I think. That's not what I know, but that's what I think. And I'm open to someone else, anyone else that wants to weigh in with a different view or
two verses today that had to do with angels and human ladies and angels, male, but then that one about Seth and Cain came up, and I thought, yeah, that's probably the right thing.
It's the one that makes the most sense, right?
Right.
That why would even fallen angels? Why would they take on the form of man? Why would an angel that's in the presence of God, why would he choose to leave that? And even if he did, we have no evidence in Scripture that these angels are able to reproduce.
That's another problem. That's an apologetic problem there because of the DNA involved. They're two different created beings.
Right. Now the giants, the Nephilim. The Nephilim. Turn over to Numbers chapter 13. Now some say that these giants were sort of these half angel, half human beings. That's what made them so big. That's what made them so powerful. Yes, Mark. Numbers 13. Well, that's one thing that some people will, that's a conclusion that some will come to. Let's look at verses 31 through 33. Now, Numbers 13, this wasn't in the assigned reading, but maybe somebody looked it up as they ran across this word Nephilim and were wondering, does this come up anywhere else in the Bible? Well, Numbers 13, we have the 10 spies going to spy out Canaan. And they give a report of some of the things that they see. Somebody read. If you want to take a microphone, it'll be even better. To read verses 31 through 33 of Numbers 13.
Then the men who had gone up with him said, "We are not able to go up against the people, for they are stronger than we are." So they brought to the people of Israel a bad report of the land that they had spied out, saying, "The land through which we have gone to spy it out is the land that devours its inhabitants. And all the people that we saw in it are of great height. And there we saw the Nephilim, the sons of Anak, who come from the Nephilim. And we seemed to ourselves like grasshoppers. And so we seemed to them."
These were people who existed in the days of the Israelites and during the time of their wandering in the wilderness. And they existed here in Genesis chapter 6. Nephilim, let's just say they were half angel, half man. What happened to them in the flood? They were gone. They were gone. So did they come back? Did more angels come down and result in more Nephilim? It doesn't make a lot of sense. These were just big people, is the most logical, most reasonable conclusion. I think probably the only reason that we might start to think that these could be angels, these sons of God could be angels, is because angels are referred to as sons of God in Scripture. But we're children of God, right? We're not angels. If you are a male and you're a Christian, you're a child of God, you're a son of God. If you're a female and you're a Christian, you're a child of God, you are a daughter of God. And if you are a female and you're not a Christian, you're a daughter of man, right? Kathy, I don't know if that answers your question, but that's sort of the reasoning I use to come up with what I think. But I could be convinced otherwise, probably. But that's just, to me, the most logical explanation of these Nephilim and these sons of God, daughters of man.
This thing on in Numbers, I think, was an exaggeration. And probably born out of fear and lack of faith, since they're opposite one another.
Mm-hmm.
Caleb and Joshua didn't have that fear.
That's true.
You know, they were faithful.
That's right. Mark.
Any
We don't see any in Scripture.
Okay. That's why I was asking. I just didn't know maybe if they were angels and they just became mortal or come to earth.
We don't see any examples of that in Scripture.
I've dug into this quite a bit. I work shift work, so I got tons of time at night to just explore the ends of my, you know, my curiosity. But there are books that are not in our Bible that, and this is one of those things where you either say, "Oh, Brandon's drinking the Kool-Aid," or, you know, I'm just throwing it out there. So there are other books that are not in our Bible, whether they are actual divine inspired works or they're something that somebody made afterwards to fill in the story. Take that how you want. But there is a book of Enoch, and it explains some of these holes that we have in Genesis in trying to understand. Now, like I say, I'm not saying that that is the truth, but there are other works that do kind of fill in some of these holes, whether it be, you know, fact or not. But it does talk about it being angels. Like in the book of Enoch, it was the watchers. They called them the watchers, and they would come, like there was some kind of different dynamic between heaven and earth or something, supposedly. And what had happened is the angels had come down, and that was before they were cast out, you know, the third or whatever that got cast out of heaven or something. But anyhow, there's a guy, his name is Trey Smith, and he's thrown together a whole lot of, like, weird stuff. You know, biblical stuff, and he's got a whole testimony and everything too. But I've wondered about this, and I've looked at this a lot. But by no means do I consider myself any kind of outlet of any kind of wisdom on this situation. So,
anything else in chapter 6?
One day I was reading this, and at the end of that verse there, it said, famous warriors, men of renown. I thought, you know, that's probably how mythologies began, because all ancient civilizations have these demigods, you know, and that they were these men, you know. Mm-hmm.
You know, one thing the scriptures warn us about in 1 Timothy 1, it talks about people who devote themselves to myths and endless genealogies. And here's the key phrase: such things promote controversial speculations rather than advancing God's work, which is by faith. So sometimes we just have to say, I don't know, but what is the core message that the Bible is getting across to us?
That's right. That's right. Chapter 7. Again, God said to Noah, the ark is completed, right? The ark is ready. And God says, go into the ark, you and your household. Take with you these animals, right? Seven pairs of all clean, seven pairs of birds. For in 7 days, I will send rain on the earth, 40 days and 40 nights. And we see throughout the rest of our this reading, seven's repeated a lot. 40s repeated a lot. Are those numbers significant? Or are they symbolic? We could. We'll get there in 7 or 8 years, BJ. Yeah.
Remember that, huh? I'll remember that.
Mark.
One of the things that I was thinking about there says to take seven pair of clean and one pair of unclean. Mm-hmm. How do you clean and unclean? Moses hadn't made seen yet.
Well, what made an animal unclean was, well, what made an animal clean was a split hoof and they chew their cud.
Wait, split hoof and what?
Chew their cud. It means they regurgitate and chew it and swallow it and throw it.
I didn't understand.
So that makes it clean.
Yes. Right, a split hoof. Mm-hmm. Yep. So, and it had to be both. Couldn't be one or the other. It had to be both. To be clean. But how he knew what was clean and unclean, I don't know. I don't know if he knew. But remember, this is written to a Jewish audience. And so they would understand the distinction between clean and unclean. And they'd also understand why there needed to be more clean than unclean.
Who's the writer of the book?
You want to know who I think? I think Moses.
Yeah.
So
Moses would know.
Right. And this is, and is, he was intimately familiar with the law. And so he absolutely would know this. And the readers, the Israelites, would recognize this distinction between clean and unclean.
The problem with getting those animals on wasn't really a problem, I don't think, because God was the one who was speaking.
Yes.
And he said, put them on the on the ship. He didn't say go round them up and then put them on, make all the decisions. I think God took care of all that stuff, and Moses, he just made sure there weren't any duplications there. Guys trying to get on board that shouldn't be there.
But here's what we know for sure. God said, go into the ark with your family, take all these animals with you that I'm telling you to take. And Noah did all that the Lord had commanded him. Again, we see God saying, do this, and Noah doing that. Who was saved in the flood? Only Noah and his wife. His three sons and their wives. That's it. That's it. Of all the people in the world, they were the only eight people who survived. Of all the animals in the world, only the animals on that boat survived. It's always made me wonder how do fish die in a flood? No, but they did, right? They did. I know they did.
Put them in fresh water, and they will survive there. Now, I would imagine with all the water coming up out of the earth and coming down from the clouds and everything, the salinity of the oceans would have changed a lot. And I don't know if mm-hmm. that would have... I would imagine that there'd be a whole lot of animals that just died because of that. However, the number of species in the oceans today is a wonderfully big number. That's all I got to say about that.
So it rains for 40 days and 40 nights. And then the water stayed there for 40 days. Days, right? Another 40. But let's back up. Noah got these animals. He got his family. He got this food. He got it on the ark, and then he shut the door behind him. Is that significant? God shut the door. Could Noah open it, you think? Would Noah want to open it? What about when these people, the floodwaters start rising and these people start wanting to get on the boat. You think they wanted to? You think these people were wanting to get on the ark with Noah? You think they started to believe what he said was going to happen, or was happening? You think Noah a blameless man, a righteous man, would want to have compassion on these people and let them on the boat? He couldn't do it. The door was shut. And so it's significant. The Lord shut him in. And so the water's up. And as the rain stops, the water ultimately prevails on the earth for 150 days. And you can look just about every different person that you read about how long all of this, what period of time, how many days all of this covers, will give you a different answer. It doesn't matter ultimately how many days the water was on, was above the ground. It doesn't matter how many days that Noah was just floating in the boat before the waters went down enough that he landed on top of a mountain. Does that matter?
No.
Do we have to know that number exactly? Okay. If we have to know, somebody tell me the number exactly, because if we have to know, I want to know for sure. But I don't know if we can know for sure. It's because we don't have to know. What else from chapter 7?
You know, of course, he had a short sermon, three words, it was going to rain. But he says that he was a, Peter calls him a preacher of righteousness. So obviously, the whole 120 years it took him to build the ark, he was telling people why he was doing what he was doing, but no one listened but his family.
That's right. That's success, right? If no one listens to you in terms of the gospel, the truth of God's word and salvation. If no one listens to you except your family, have you been successful? If they listen? Absolutely. So Noah was a successful preacher of righteousness. Chapter 8. Now apparently, God lost track of the days too. And maybe that's why we can't necessarily piece it together right. Because here all of a sudden, in chapter 8 verse 1, God remembered Noah. He had forgotten him, I guess.
Wish he wouldn't have let the mosquitoes in.
Chapter 8, verse 3. It says, and the water receded steadily from the earth, and at the end of 150 days, the water deceased.
Yes.
That's more than 80, I mean, you know, 40 days, 40 nights.
Right. Right. The waters prevailed on the earth 150 days, and then at the end of 150 days, the waters had abated or
receded.
And then the ark came to rest. And then at the end of 40 days, Noah opened the window. And so we get a lot of numbers here, a lot of days. And does this... this 150 days at the end of chapter 7, is that the same as the 150 days here at the beginning of chapter 8, or is that an additional 150 days? See, that's what I mean. I don't know that we can know, and it doesn't matter that whether we know or not. Yes,
well,
PJ.
In verse 22 in chapter 27, I'm going back to the questioning of the fish and the water dying. It said, everything on the dry land whose nostrils was the breath of life died. Did he wipe out everything in the sea too?
I think he had to.
Okay, I'm just asking. I'm just for clarification, I'm just asking.
Sure. And when the water receded, could they live 150 days on dry land? Doubtful.
If the water receded, they were on dry land. Yes.
So we don't worry about aquariums on the ark either, do we? So
Then you ask the question, what does this have to do with my salvation? You know, in the end.
But. Mm-hmm. Yes.
And all the creatures that swam over the earth, is that over the earth and not in the water?
I'm looking at chapter 8. Sorry.
721.
721. All swarming creatures that swarm on the earth.
I can't read. Okay, never mind.
Okay, swarm and swim are two different words.
Swarm, yeah, my bees swarm.
So chapter 8, God remembered Noah. What's it mean that God remembered Noah? He hadn't forgotten him, had he? So what's it mean? Okay. Okay. The definition of the Hebrew word means to pay attention, to fulfill a promise, to act on behalf of someone. And so God paid attention to Noah and all the beasts and all the livestock that were in the ark with him. And God made a wind. And he dried up the land. After 40 days, Noah opens the window, and he sends out a bird, a raven. And the raven came back. And so after 7 days, he sends out another bird, a dove. And that dove comes back, but it's different this time. What's different? Olive branch. And so what does that tell Noah? Right, first time he came back with nothing. Second time he had the olive branch. That tells him waters are down enough. At least there's some vegetation that's living, and this bird was able to bring it back. And then he waits another 7 days, and he sends it out again, and what happens? Doesn't come back. In the 601st year, in the first month, the first day of the month, the waters were dried from off the earth. Noah removed the covering of the ark and looked, and behold, the face of the ground was dry. In the second month, on the 27th day of the month, the earth had dried out. Then God said to Noah, go out from the ark. You and your wife, your sons and your sons' wives with you, bring out with you every living thing that is with you of all flesh, birds and animals and creeping things, everything that creeps on the earth. May swarm on the earth, be fruitful, and multiply the earth. See the contrast with the get on, go in, take with you these people. Now God is saying, go out and take off with you these people and these animals. And guess what? So Noah went out. Noah did what God told him to do. Every time God told Noah to do something, what did Noah do? He did it. That's something interesting that we see repeating throughout these chapters. And when Noah gets off the boat, he builds an altar. And he took some of every clean animal and some of every clean bird and offered burnt offerings on the altar. And the Lord smelled the pleasing aroma. And the Lord said in his heart, this great promise, right? I will never curse the ground because of man. For the intention of man's heart is evil from his youth. Neither will I ever strike down every living creature as I have done. While the earth remains, seed time and harvest, cold and heat, summer and winter, day and night shall not cease. God makes this great promise to Noah in response to what? Noah's worship. How about that? Anything in chapter 8 before we get to chapter 9?
They weren't two by two when they got off the boat. They were families.
Okay.
So
they've already started multiplying the creatures before they even got off.
You know, it's an amazing miracle in that ark, right? They're a long time on that ark. There's a lot of animals on that ark. There's a limited supply of food on that ark. There's a limited supply of bathroom stalls on that ark, right? And shower stalls. How did they do it? They stayed at the top. But it happened, though, right? Through God's grace. Chapter 9. God bless Noah and his sons. Be fruitful and multiply, fill the earth. The fear of you and the dread of you shall be upon every beast of the earth and every bird of the heavens and upon everything that creeps on the ground and all the fish in the sea. Every moving thing that lives shall be food for you. Before the flood, every person was vegetarian, or supposed to be, right? Or at least supposed to be. And you get the impression that you didn't find a bunch of scared animals huddled up by the walls of the ark. You didn't find predator and prey having conflict on the ark, because that idea was not in existence until after the flood. See, God's smarter than we are, isn't he? Blood's important to God, isn't it? Whoever sheds the blood of man, by man shall his blood be shed. For God made man in his own image. God tells them again, be fruitful and multiply. Now, in verses 9, or 8 rather, 8 through 17, we see a word repeated 7 times. At least in the English Standard Version, it's repeated 7 times. That word is covenant. What's covenant mean? Okay, an agreement, a bond, a pact, a promise. What? A sacred covenant. Okay, a sacred bond, a sacred oath. God is making this covenant. If God makes a covenant, who has the authority to break that covenant or change that covenant? Did Noah have any negotiating power when it came to this covenant? I want to read those verses and think about how important God's word is to God. God said to Noah and to his sons with him, behold, I establish my covenant with you and your offspring after you, and with every living creature that is with you, the birds, the livestock, and every beast of the earth with you. As many as come out of the ark, it is for every beast of the earth. I establish my covenant with you that never again shall all flesh be cut off by the waters of the flood, and never again shall there be a flood to destroy the earth. And God said, this is the sign of the covenant that I make between you and every living creature that's with you for all future generations. I have set my bow in the cloud, and it shall be a sign of the covenant between me and the earth. When I bring clouds over the earth and the bow is seen in the clouds, I will remember my covenant that is between me and you and every creature of all flesh. And water shall never again become a flood to destroy all flesh. When the bow is in the clouds, I will see it and remember the everlasting covenant between God and every living creature of all flesh that's on the earth. God said to Noah, this is the sign of the covenant that I have established between me and all the flesh on the earth. God made Noah a promise, but not just to Noah, right? The descendants of Noah received that same promise. Do we benefit from this covenant? we know that the earth will not be destroyed with a flood. It may rain so hard that Enterprise Boulevard is flooded and the building begins to flood, but the earth is not going to be destroyed. Mankind will not be wiped out by a flood. God has promised that. God has made that promise, and when God makes a promise, what does he do? He keeps it. He always keeps his promise. And when Noah came off the ark, he offers this sacrifice. God says, be fruitful and multiply, fill the earth. Everything's good. Here's Noah. He's this righteous man, this blameless man, and he lives a perfect life. I mean, why wouldn't he? Because he has recognized, God's speaking directly to him, and he's recognized that God is all-powerful, that God does what he says he will do. He's just seen God destroy every man because of their sin. And so why wouldn't he be perfect? Because he's human. Because he's human. And so we find he begins to work the ground. He plants a vineyard. And he got drunk and he took his clothes off and laid down in his tent. And here come his boys. And poor Canaan, right? Poor Canaan. I mean, Gary just laughed. Cursed be Gary, right? And we don't have to necessarily understand why Canaan was cursed and the others were not. Obviously, we see what happens in the story that Shem and Japheth, they covered their father while Ham was making fun, disrespecting, dishonoring his father. And so we understand the why, but it's not like these other two boys were perfect either, right? So Right. It's God expects, and he's always expected. It would be something to write probably on a timeless truth. God expects children to honor their parents. And maybe even, as we see with Shem and Japheth, go so far as to preserve the honor of their parents. Not to cover up the sin that Noah had committed, but to limit the embarrassment, to limit the exposure, no pun intended, but to always strive to bring honor to your parents.
He could have seen him and probably not have committed a sin.
Sure.
But God knows the heart. And when he saw his father, whatever was already in his heart spilled out. And he dishonored his father and went out and then made fun of him to the other two brothers.
That's right.
So that's sin.
So we're just going to jump over this because I think we've covered a little bit of what it means or what it would have meant to those first readers, the Israelites. So how does it relate? How does all of this, how does Noah and the flood and the aftermath, how does all of this relate to us? Does it? Is it just a good story to tell our kids? It's really not a cute story, is it? Okay.
Yeah, I think it demonstrates that God hates sin, and his creation disappointed him because the thoughts of man were on evil continually, both day and night. And And so God provided a way through the grace to Noah to reinstitute what he had created.
Okay. Is that the second one, John? Wow. That's right. I got that on my list too. Go ahead, Kathy.
I was just going to say that I've always considered it an uplifting story in a way, too, because no matter how much evil and violence and things you see on TV, I look around and I see how much good there still is in the world, and I think, well, no matter how bad it is, it's still not as bad as it was then.
That's true. That's true. I want to share one thing. In the story of Noah, we see faith, works, and grace all being necessary for salvation. Not independent of each other, but dependent on each other. Faith, works, and grace. And we see that as a New Testament principle as well. It hit me today. I guess it's hit me before, but it hit me today like never before. Grace came first. Grace came first. Noah found grace. And then he had faith. And then he obeyed. We know that it was in that order for Noah because of Hebrews 11, verse 7. By faith, Noah built an ark. Next week, we're going to back off a little bit. We covered a lot of ground this week. We're going to back off and just do 9 verses. How about that? Genesis 11, 1 through 9. And I have a feeling your papers will be just as full if you're writing on these papers. Thanks for your comments and your attention.